From Portland, Oregon, this is the Jewish Review Podcast. I'm Rockney Roll. Coming up this episode, in less than a week, the votes will be counted in the 2024 U.S. presidential election, as well as a host of down-ballot races that will affect every facet of government and society. Thinking that listeners might enjoy a brief respite from all that this election entails, we're taking an opportunity to delve into elections past. To that end, I spoke to Professor Ellen Eisenberg, the Dwight and Margaret Lear Professor of American History at Willamette University in Salem, an expert in American Jewish history and the author of five books, including a two-volume history of Jews in Oregon. Professor Eisenberg and I chatted about the three distinct phases of Jewish involvement in Oregon politics, went over parts of the impressive roster of Jews elected to high office in the state, and looked at how Portland's progressive streak and Jewish involvement in that movement emerged together in the second half of the 20th century. Stay with us. The Jewish Review Podcast is brought to you by the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland, presenting A Time to Be Together, featuring Comedy for Peace, with two shows Sunday, November 17th, at the Middleman Jewish Community Center in Portland. Learn more and get your tickets for either show before November 6th online at jewishportland.org/comedyforpeace. Now, here's Ellen Eisenberg. Ellen Eisenberg, welcome to the Jewish Review Podcast.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I'm glad to have you here. So tell me about your Jewish journey.
Well, I grew up in a suburban Jewish community outside of Washington, D.C. in Potomac, Maryland. My parents both were New Yorkers, transplanted to Washington, D.C. after a very brief time in Oregon before I was born. And I had, I guess, what I would consider your kind of average suburban Jewish upbringing. The area where I lived, my high school was probably about 30% Jewish, and I was very involved. You know, I did the whole run of Hebrew school and Bar Bat Mitzvah, but I was super involved in BBYO as a teenager. I had my first experience in Israel there. I later returned in college to Israel and spent what was supposed to be part of a year that turned into nearly 2 years. Met my husband there on a kibbutz. And then in grad school, I went to grad school in history, in American history, not decided on focusing on American Jewish history. And then that kind of evolved during my time in graduate school. It's hard to separate my personal Jewish journey from my kind of professional engagement in American Jewish history.
Funny how that works out.
In any event, out of grad school, I got a job here in Salem at Willamette University. This is now my 35th year at Willamette, which is kind of shocking to say,
and
makes me feel super old. And I'm a member of the congregation here in Salem, Temple Beth Shalom, which is a Reconstructionist congregation. And at this point in my life, I'm an active supporter of the congregation, but I consider myself much more of a kind of cultural Jew, maybe, than a religious one.
And I understand you've written a book.
I've written a few books, yeah. Most immediately relevant to our conversation today is that I wrote two books on Jews in Oregon, one that goes up to about 1950 and one from about 1950 on.
I believe I have copies of both of those on my desk that I am thumbing through, so it's nice to put a face to an author's name.
Glad you have them.
So I guess with any discussion of Jews in American political life, we have to go back to this famous letter that George Washington wrote to a Jewish congregation in Rhode Island. Can you briefly skim over, for the benefit of our listeners, what that letter was and why it's so foundational to American Jewish life?
Sure. So the letter is actually a response to a letter from the community in Rhode Island in 1790. And in many ways, George Washington gets his words from them. So they write to him kind of a congratulatory letter and looking for assurance of their place in America. And he uses some of their language, that the phrase that's often quoted actually comes from their language, to give a couple sentences of it. He writes, "The citizens of the United States have a right to applaud themselves for having given to mankind examples of an enlarged and liberal policy, a policy worthy of imitation. All possess alike liberty of conscience and immunities of citizenship. It is now no more that toleration is spoken of, as if it was by the indulgence of one class of people that another enjoy the exercise of their inherent natural rights. For happily the government of the United States, which gives bigotry no sanction, to persecution, no assistance, requires only that they who live under its protection should demean themselves as good citizens. And it goes on. So that bigotry, no sanction is usually the piece that's most quoted. But this idea that this is not, you're not living here at the indulgence of some majority power, right? You have full rights like all other American citizens. And then that letter is then, it's reread and reread ceremonially and kind of as the official word of George Washington that Jews are welcome.
That's a fairly profound sentiment, if for no other reason than nobody had ever bothered to really put it to paper before.
Obviously, Thomas Jefferson talks about religious freedom. Other people talk about religious freedom, but this particular phrase ends up becoming a kind of cornerstone of Jews' understanding of what their place in America should be. And it's often quoted when blocks or problems or prejudice in trying to enter the public arena. Mm-hmm.
So your interpretation, your assessment of Jewish involvement in Oregon political life is best understood in three distinct phases, if I recall. Can you sort of explain those three phases to me?
Absolutely. So I think it's important to start by saying that despite Washington's letter, there are restrictions on Jews in some states. So at the federal level, there aren't clauses. But for example, Maryland, where I grew up, although I did not know this when I was growing up, actually had a requirement for office holders to declare a belief in Christianity, to be sworn into office. And that doesn't get overturned until 1826. It's after a long fight, a 30-year fight, actually. Nothing like that ever existed in Oregon. So when I think about these three phases I talk about in Jews in Oregon politics, the first is a phase that's really characterized by inclusion. Being Jewish is not an issue for many of the early office holders. And there actually are a lot of Jews. I mean, there aren't a lot of Jews here, but proportionately, there are a number of Jews that are involved in politics in Oregon. And that persists throughout the 19th century. Mm-hmm. Then we get to a phase when national levels of anti-Semitism and xenophobia rise, in part in response to the immigration of Eastern Europeans. We get to a phase where there's a lot less security within the community, and the community starts to take on more of what we could call an ethnic character. And at that phase, there are both kind of Jewish issues that are perceived as ethnic issues, and also there's a lot less involvement of Jews as political office holders in public life. There are some glaring exceptions to that, but we see not as open a field to Jews. Mm-hmm. And then in the post-war period, we see a direct engagement of Jewish communities publicly with issues of public concern, with controversial issues, and really moving into a leadership role in the Democratic Party as it kind of reemerges in Oregon as a powerful party in the second half of the 20th century, and with the real focus on issues connected to civil rights in particular.
Mm-hmm. So let's go back to that. The first phase, who were some of the perhaps memorable figures in Jewish Oregon politics from that period?
Yeah, well, I think the first thing I would say about that is that there are a lot of people engaged in politics all over the state in the most unlikely places that you would never associate with Jewish life. Mm-hmm. So you think of someone like Julius Durkheimer, who was a mayor in Burns, Oregon, of all places, in the 1890s. Or an 1880s era mayor was Henry Blackman in Heppner, Oregon, which I'm guessing most people would have trouble finding on a map. It's kind of right in the middle, kind of southwest of Pendleton. So these are places that we don't at all associate with Jewish life. But in that early period, starting in the 1850s, there are Jewish merchants in virtually every small town in Oregon. And they're extraordinarily well accepted, in part because they have a stake. They're considered pioneers. They have a stake in these growing communities. They hold important positions as merchants because most of the other people are, you know, farmers or miners or whatever, and they rely on merchants both for credit and to buy goods. And so these folks emerge as sort of pillars of the community. They often build the first brick building in town, that kind of thing. They have a real stake in the Chamber of Commerce, and that leads naturally to local offices. So not just mayors, but there are probably scores of people who are city councilors and hold various local offices. And then that kind of leads up to this office holding as mayors and so on. Portland has two Jewish mayors in the 19th century, Bernard Goldsmith and Philip Wassermann, who follow each other in term. So Goldsmith's elected in 1869, or he serves, I guess, from 1869 to 1871, and he's immediately followed by Wassermann. They, like a lot of the other Jewish office holders at that time, what I think really characterizes them is that while they're Jewish, they're not at all perceived as Jewish candidates or particularly enmeshed in Jewish interests. They're merchants, they're members of a class interest, and they're perceived just as kind of generic civic leaders. So, So when I was doing the research on them, I was fortunate enough to be doing it at a time when newspapers were already digitized. And so I was able to search the newspapers for all of their names in proximity to words like Israelite, Hebrew, Jewish, to see if they were tagged, right? Because that was very commonplace in earlier newspapers in New York and other places. If they talked about a Jewish politician, they would note their Jewishness, right? Kind of marking them as other. That didn't happen in Oregon. They're just talked about as pioneers for the most part, unless they happen to be doing something Jewish. So if they get married in a synagogue, then that might be noted in the wedding announcement in the paper. But when they're running for mayor or for state legislature, it doesn't say, you know, the Jewish candidate from such and so a place.
Was that a byproduct of any particular attempt by these men, and they are all men, to play down their Jewish ancestry and heritage? Or is that just a sort of, I guess, profound statement on the equality that we saw in political life in that time and place?
It's more the latter, which is not to say that there's no manifestation of anti-Jewish feeling at all, but these are individuals who are very invested in being American and present themselves as part of the community and reflecting the community interests. And frankly, you know, there's not enough of a Jewish population to have an ethnic candidate really in Oregon. And it's also in part of the role that they played, many of them as pioneers or children of pioneers. Mm-hmm. So they did all of the sort of things that are celebrated in other pioneers. They come early on, they help to establish cities. In some cases, they support and or fight in the Indian Wars, which is something that we look at more critically now, but at the time it was a cause for celebration of inclusion. And so they're viewed as part of that pioneer society and accepted as a part of that in social organizations as well as in politics.
When do those dynamics start to shift?
Just after the turn of the century. So in addition, I should add that in addition to these kind of small town mayors and so on and Portland mayors, there are also major leaders in political parties. And so I would be remiss if I didn't mention Joseph Simon, who is considered really probably the most powerful individual in Oregon politics of his time. He served in the Portland City Council. He was a Republican power broker, both at the county and then the statewide level, served in the state Senate, and then was elected to the U.S. Senate. Mm-hmm. He was a U.S. senator. And then after he returned, after the turn of the century, he was a mayor of Portland. You know, he was a particularly prominent individual. I did some analysis when he was elected to the Senate, and it was interesting that around the country, as this was covered, it was always mentioned that he was a Jewish senator. There was some controversy about whether he was the second or the fourth, but it was consistently mentioned in the headlines. In the Oregon newspapers, it wasn't, just wasn't mentioned. And so I think that's kind of emblematic of that. It starts to change around the turn of the century. Part of it is a national shift. So there's mass immigration, not just of Jews, but of others, and yeah. Jews and some of these other groups like Italians and so on are considered undesirable. There's a rise in xenophobia. It really peaks right after World War I. And at this time, you do have an influx of Eastern European Jews to Portland, and they are much more concentrated in Portland than their predecessors have been. The predecessors have been scattered around the state. These folks live in what we would consider an ethnic neighborhood, although South Portland is by no means all Jewish. It's a pretty heterogeneous neighborhood, but it does have a substantial Jewish community. So you start having this more kind of ethnic expression, and you also have it in the face of both generalized xenophobia and specific anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. And so that manifests in politics in a couple of different ways. One is that there are issues that are ethnic issues. A good example of that would be prohibition. Supporters of prohibition tend to come from particular religious backgrounds, generally Protestants. There's a lot of overlap between the rise of the KKK in Oregon and support for prohibition. Jews tend to be anti-prohibition, also anti-KKK,
naturally. Right?
And so those are some of the dynamics in Oregon politics in the World War I and immediately after period. By that point, there's enough of a Jewish concentration in South Portland that you can kind of use the South Portland vote as a bit of a proxy to get some sense, not exact, but some sense of how Jews are voting. Mm-hmm. And in the Jewish areas in Portland, they vote overwhelmingly against prohibition, even though prohibition passes by a substantial margin in the state. There's a similar kind of ethnically significant vote in a ballot measure in 1916, which is about overturning the Sunday closure laws. Obviously, Jews vote in favor of getting rid of Sunday closure laws, and they vote for that, and far that neighborhood votes for that in far greater numbers. And then the KKK-sponsored measures in the early 20s also, you get what I would consider an ethnic vote turnout. Mm-hmm. So that's part of that era. But at the same time, during that era, you see a lot less in terms of Jews in elected public office.
Is that because they're running for public office and losing, or they're just withdrawing from that part of political life?
I think that there's just less involvement in that part of political life. And it's interesting to kind of see what I call minority consciousness. So this sense of themselves as a minority, mm-hmm. and identification with other minority groups really starts to well up in this early 20th century period, particularly in the 1920s. This is not unique to Oregon. So this is something that's happening nationally in the Jewish press, and you see it in the local Jewish newspaper, which at that time is the Scribe. So they talk a lot about prejudice and anti-Semitism, but they generalize it to other forms of prejudice. They start expressing sympathy with African Americans, particularly in other places. So they're reluctant to comment on local issues. Mm-hmm. but are very vocal in commenting on these kind of national issues. And you just see it kind of retiring from that speaking out publicly about volatile local issues. So, yeah.
So if those folks, if Jewish Portlanders are, and this is, as you mentioned, this is the period of time where Jewish population is really starting to concentrate in Portland, mm-hmm. if Jewish Portlanders aren't running for office themselves, are there candidates that are intentionally pursuing that Jewish vote that's emerging?
Yeah, I would say not so much, in part because Jews are still a tiny, tiny minority in this period. I mean, they're perpetually a tiny minority, but in, you know, they're less than 2% nationally. In Oregon, they're way less than 1%. And even in Portland, they're a very small fraction. So like pursuit of a Jewish vote, not as such. And you see fewer, I mean, some of the people I mentioned from the late 19th century spill into the 20th century. Mm-hmm. So you still have several folks who are in the state legislature, most notably Joseph Simon as mayor of Portland in the first decade of the 20th century. So you see some of those folks. And of course, the biggest exception of all is Julius Meyer in 1930. And he's an important person to mention here. He's an exception in so many ways to all of this. He is definitely identifiable as a Jew. He's very well known as part of the Meyer family, which is part of the Meyer and Frank department store, which is, of course, well known statewide. He is not a politician. He actually gets into the race, the gubernatorial race in 1930, kind of by accident. So he is very close friends with a man named George Joseph, who was a progressive Republican candidate. Mm-hmm. And George Joseph dies midway through that campaign. And the Republican Party replaces him with an old line conservative Republican, which Myers objects to. And so he steps into the race as an independent candidate, and he wins more than the Republican and the Democrat combined. So this is an exceptional race in every single regard. And he also is, his Jewishness is quite public. In fact, he becomes the president of Congregation Beth Israel in Portland while he is still sitting governor. So that's kind of an exception to everything on all counts.
Indeed.
Yeah, and kind of interesting case.
Were there ways that Governor Myers' term as governor was marked by his Jewishness, either in policies he pursued as governor or other notable outward demonstrations of that?
Both positively and negatively. So it's important to say that there is an explicitly anti-Semitic campaign against him when he runs. Mm-hmm. So there's a weekly publication called The Oregon Voter at that time, and they feature kind of a series of very anti-Semitic front page cartoons of him, depicting him as kind of a greedy, kind of evoking some of these old tropes.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, he wins the election. But so you have the anti-Semitism very explicitly in a way that you just do not back, you know, 30 years before with Simon's campaign, for example. In terms of his policy, well, he runs as a much more progressive candidate. Mm-hmm. And I think that's reflective of the shift in the Jewish community at that time, nationally and locally. So in that sense, yes. So for example, one of his big issues is public ownership of power. So for example, of electrical power through dams on the Columbia and that kind of thing. That's one of his big issues. And so that's a progressive issue. It's not a Jewish issue as such, but it's reflective of this increasing progressive posture of the Jewish community. Yeah.
Before that, I guess we'll go back a little bit, but before this sort of merger between Jewish political identity and progressive politics, was the Jewish community unified around any sort of particular political ideology?
I'd say no. Most of the people who served in office in the 19th century and into the early 20th century who were Jewish, the majority of them, like Simon, like some of these mayors and so on, were Republican business interest kind of politicians. Mm-hmm. And so as the immigrant community starts to grow around the turn of the century, which is many of them are small merchants, but a lot of them have a more labor-oriented sensibility. As Eastern Europeans, there's not really a lot of alignment. There's some exception, for example, with somebody like Ben Selling, who is a politician, but who's remembered much more as a philanthropist and a supporter of all kinds of causes, Jewish and otherwise. And you know, he serves terms in both the state legislature and the state Senate. He serves as leader of both of those bodies. This is early 20th century. Mm-hmm. He is both a more progressive candidate and is also more kind of embraced by the emerging community in South Portland, right? As somebody who's a supporter of their causes. It's worth mentioning, of course, that his wife, Tilly Selling, is the longtime president of Neighborhood House, which is a key institution serving that population. Mm-hmm. So he's kind of the transitional character, I would say, towards a more progressive stance. And of course, that's a reflection of national politics and the emergence of the progressive movement and all of that. But those 19th century politicians were much more kind of reflective of their class position as successful businessmen than they were ethnic candidates.
Fair enough. What really marks the transition into that sort of third phase in this political history and the reemergence of Jews into Oregon political life in a notable way?
Yeah, and a reemergence, I would say, in a more identifiably Jewish way, in that many of the people in this generation talk about their concerns as in part a product of their Jewish identity. So these are folks really that start to emerge in the 1950s. And they are engaged in progressive liberal causes. And this is a time of real transition in Oregon and particularly in Portland, where we have the reemergence of the Democratic Party. And, you know, the way that people think of Portland today as this bastion of liberalism, right, that image starts to emerge in the period that we're talking about here. And it's a group that includes people who are from here, people like Gus Solomon, who came of age in the 20s, who have personal experiences with anti-Semitism and exclusion. So people like Gus Solomon, he finishes law school, I think it's 1929. And basically, there's not a law firm in Portland that will hire a Jew, period. Right. And it's for that reason that he kind of hangs up a shingle and an office that he shares with a couple of other lawyers. And they take on many kind of ACLU type civil rights type cases. And so they start getting involved in that work and they have an investment in it personally. They themselves are facing exclusions. And then after the war, they're joined by a whole cadre of lawyers, some of whom are from here, some of whom come from back east, who are very invested in civil rights and related causes in the 1950s and 60s. And so if you look at Portland in the 1950s, the ACLU, for example, forms a chapter in 1955. The majority of the people on the committee that form that group and the majority of officers in the initial ACLU organization locally are Jewish. And they share this background as Jewish lawyers. And they are, when they talk about their involvement, they put it in very Jewish terms, that they are connecting this both to the experiences of their families, many of whom were refugees from Russia, some of whom were Holocaust survivors, right, or who escaped Nazism, and also their personal experience of trying to get jobs or pledge fraternities or whatever the case may be in the 1940s and 50s when Jews are excluded. And they bring all of that to the table. And they play a really tremendously important role in both city and state civil rights legislation and civil rights activism.
And then eventually this history evolves to where we, of course, have another Jewish leader in Mahoney Hall, the governor's mansion, in the form of Neil Goldschmidt. How do we get from this early reemergence post-World War II to where we're electing another Jewish governor?
There are actually really direct connections. So Neil Goldschmidt is a little younger than the other folks that I was just talking about, but they all become sort of interconnected in a number of ways. Many of them are connected to Dick Neuberger, who, of course, serves in the State House, State Senate, and then is elected to the U.S. Senate. He dies in office in 1960, but a number of these folks were connected to him, worked on his campaign, were involved in the ACLU, were involved in various local issues. For example, several of them are involved in efforts to desegregate Portland public schools. Neil Goldschmidt, as a college student, interns for Maureen Neuberger, who is Dick Neuberger's widow, who assumes his seat after his death in 1960. So there are these connections between these folks. Neil Goldschmidt is an activist student. He was the organizer for the Western Region for Freedom Summer, and he got into politics really young. He served as city commissioner and then was elected. I think he was the youngest mayor ever in Portland, elected 1972, served for a couple of terms. He's then in the Carter administration as the Secretary of Transportation, and then he's later elected governor in 1987. In a lot of the causes that he's involved in, so his involvement in civil rights, and then later his city-level involvement, which is around a coalition of issues that connect to kind of livability, so public transportation, neighborhood engagement, making way for bikes, things that we still associate with Portland. He's very much in line with this whole generation. But of course, his legacy is very overshadowed and viewed in light of what came out well after he had left office. Came out in 2004 that when he had been mayor back in the 70s, he had sexually abused a teenage girl who was a babysitter for the family and neighbor from the time that she was 13 over a period of several years. And it's actually for that reason that he doesn't run for re-election. It's his fear that the story will come out, although the story actually doesn't come out until over a decade later.
Yeah. So moving from Governor Goldschmidt to some of the more modern figures in Oregon Jewish political life, tell me about that transition to where we're at now, not only with elected officials, but with Jewish involvement in politics at a more grassroots level some of the initiative campaigns that have come about in Oregon in recent decades?
Yeah, I mean, this also goes back to the 1950s. So some of the early campaigns for civil rights in Oregon were through initiatives. They were also overthrown in some cases by initiatives. So, you know, you take, for example, Goldschmidt issued an executive order that would prevent the consideration of sexual orientation in state employment. That's 1987, I want to say. I'm not 100% sure of the date. The following year, the Oregon Citizens Alliance introduces a ballot measure that ends up overturning that. Mm-hmm. So I would say gay rights, and as you probably know, and probably a lot of your listeners know, there were a lot of fights and a number of ballot measures over those issues. And the Oregon Jewish community, as well as political leaders like Ron Wyden, for example, come out very strongly in favor of gay rights. I believe Ron Wyden was one of the first to call for recognition of gay marriages in the U.S. Senate. So at the time that like the Defense of Marriage Act and all of that was being passed. So that would be an issue that I would say you see Jews prominently involved in more recent years. Vera Katz is another example, mm-hmm. right? Involved obviously in women's issues and issues of sustainability and so on that we associate with the same group. And I would say there's really a kind of through line from these folks in the 1950s up until more recent and even current. Some of the current officials, like Ellen Rosenblum, for example, was also connected to sort of this network of Jewish lawyers, a number of whom ended up in the judiciary. Somebody like Herbert Schwab, he was the leader in the 1964 investigation of segregation within the Portland Public School District. He later becomes a Court of Appeals judge, and he's connected to several of these other folks who, you know, you can kind of trace the genealogies or whatever, those legal connections among them down to folks like Ellen Rosenblum.
I believe that is unfortunately all the time we have, even though I'd love to get into this farther. Ellen Eisenberg, thank you so much for joining us on the Jewish Review podcast.
Sure. Thank you.
That's all for this episode of the Jewish Review Podcast. Thank you so much to Professor Ellen Eisenberg and to Professor Natan Meir at Portland State University for helping bring this episode together. Professor Eisenberg's most recent book is an anthology of work she edited around Jewish identity in the American West, by exactly that title, released through Brandeis University Press and available at a bookseller near you. If you like this episode, please leave a 5-star review on the podcast platform of your choice to help others find our show. Subscribe to get our latest episode every 2 weeks, and tell a friend. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions, please reach out by email to editor@jewishportland.org. Don't forget, you can get the latest news from Portland's Jewish community by subscribing to The Jewish Review online at jewishportland.org/Jewish Review. The Jewish Review podcast is a production of the Jewish Federation of Greater Portland. Our associate editor is Karone Blau-Rothstein. Special thanks to Daniel Berger. Our theme music is by Isaac Joel. I'm Rockney Roll. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, all the best.